This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Fulya Pınar. We are here today with the editors of the book Experimenting with Ethnography, a Companion to Analysis, published by the Duke University Press in 2021. Dr. Andrea Ballestero and Dr. Britt Wintayak, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, you. Fulya.
Well, let's start with the classic first question of New Books Network. So could you please tell us about your background in anthropology? Andrea?
Sure. Hello to all of our listeners. It's really wonderful to be in your companionship. And this is a very interesting question for me because my background in anthropology begins at the end, so to speak. So my original training was not in anthropology. My first degree, I should say that I spent 4 years in college in the university here in Costa Rica, where I'm from and where I'm speaking from today, taking different classes in different social sciences and humanities, and I just could not decide what it was that I wanted to study. And so after that period of time, my mom said, it's time for you to make a decision, and I decided to study law because it was the thing that I had not studied yet. After that, I did a master's in natural resource policy in the United States. And only for my PhD did I arrive to anthropology, which was a wonderful point to end and begin a new phase, as anthropology allowed me to ask the questions that I was interested in and to craft the kinds of research processes that inspired me and that felt politically responsible and important to me.
And Britt?
Yeah, hi. I also would like to thank you very much for this invitation. And I'm calling from Copenhagen, where I also did my training in anthropology. I did my bachelor's degree at University of Aarhus first, and then I moved to University of Copenhagen, where I studied anthropology until I was about to go on field work. And I had big trouble finding a supervisor who would actually help me do what I wanted to, which was technology in Europe. So I was lucky to do a PhD, which combined anthropology and science and technology studies in the Netherlands, where studying technology with ethnography using anthropological concepts and methods was a little more accepted, I felt, at that point. Of course, now I know that there are lots of people to go to, and maybe I was just not finding the right people at that time. But it just meant that I did 5 years of anthropological training, and then I did my PhD in science and technology studies using a lot of my anthropological background and training in that work. So I did a PhD on categorization as the doctors use them in electronic patient records, and became what I now think of as an infrastructure studies scholar.
That's amazing. So you two are also working in places like Ethnography Studio and Ethos Lab. So I want to ask you, what are you doing nowadays? Andrea, you can start first if you wish.
Yes. So the Ethnography Studio is a project that is dear to my heart, in large part because it is the result of my collaboration with students and faculty that we invite to join us. So the studio just finished our annual salon, just a couple of months ago. This year's theme was Refusing Poetic Restraint, and we had an amazing group of scholars visit us and an equally amazing group of students asking questions about poetic form, all of the possibilities therein, and limitations as well. So at the moment, I am working on transitioning the studio into a new institutional setting. I myself am moving institutions. I spent 9 years at Rice University, and now I'm moving to the University of Southern California, where the studio is going to take a new life after 10 years of existence already. So we're in the process of thinking forward. And that means a more systematic approach to collaborating with similar spaces around the world, including Ethos Lab and other spaces in Latin America and North America as well. So we are in the process of planning our near future.
Yeah, and it's true that I was part of starting the Ethos Lab here at the IT University of Copenhagen, where we where I'm also based, and where we have STS/anthropology/human-computer interaction/computer-supported cooperative work, other kinds of approaches to the digital world group. And Ethos Lab was our group's attempt to try to make our methods visible to the rest of the university and to potential partners outside of the university. So it was a platform and for inviting people, both our colleagues in computer science, for example, and also like societal partners, NGOs, public authorities, companies, to work with us on, what we saw as a sort of a digital ethnography, for example, visualization of qualitative data, but also working across the quali and the quantitative methods that we had students who were very interested in. So it still exists. It's run by Rachel Douglas-Jones and my colleague Marissa Cohn. And it's really an experimental space, and it's very much in the ethos that we've worked together, Andrea and I, on editing this book, because we had these similar interests that we really wanted to collaborate with others in these kind of spaces to figure out how we can push the boundaries of our methods.
That's amazing. Very exciting too. So we'll talk about the book itself in a moment, but I first wanted to make a small comment. So I was particularly excited about this book and this podcast because I myself am a PhD student and I'm currently writing my dissertation. And after coming back from the field, I often felt very lost and became quite overwhelmed with how to work through so many different materials, so many field notes, so many transcriptions, so many images, how to work on all these together and build a coherent framework. The book really demystified the processes of thinking and analyzing for me, kind of giving us a sense of how those magical moments of finding patterns and frameworks occur for many scholars in real life. And it actually provides us with some very doable, very feasible practices as well. So it's a very descriptive and also a guiding piece. It is so difficult to craft a book like this that is not overwhelming for the reader. In fact, I have multiple notes on the book right now that goes like, wow, this is exactly how I feel or how I felt. So the book definitely makes one feel like they're not alone while also teaching them new, doable, feasible practices. So I praise you and all the contributors for being able to craft this book in this way.
Thank you so much, Fulya. I wish our listeners could see my face because I'm smiling a lot right now, because this is exactly what we had in mind and exactly the kind of invitation that we wanted to make so that people felt welcome in inhabiting the analysis space rather than feeling they had to move quickly through it or just use techniques that felt too mechanic and not generative for what we love ethnography for, like the capacity to illuminate worlds that we don't quite anticipate. So thank you so much for those words. That's wonderful.
Yes, and you also said, I mean, I love that you said it made me feel, this is exactly how I feel. Because as one of our contributors, Professor Marisol de la Cadena, writes that we need to learn how to think, feel. And that's also, you know, in the spirit of the book, that kind of invitation that Andrea is speaking about, that it's trying to work on our senses in a way that goes together with our analytical repertoire and registers.
Yeah, and like, both of you said so many amazing things, and I think the book does an amazing job in what you aimed for. So let's talk about the book more specifically. How did you decide to work on this book? Did you feel like there was a certain need, a certain gap that you wanted to address with it?
Yeah, I can start. And definitely, I mean, there are many contexts for the book, and but then I will start like biographically, I think, with my own story. I went to do a research visit at University of Melbourne in 2009, visiting Helen Baran, who's also one of the contributors of the book. We were discussing this, and that was what I took with me home after leaving Australia again, you know. So what can we do to both, you know, keep the theoretical, analytical registers present, but also, you know, just come up with some advice, some stuff that people can do to try out things, and what would that book look like? So that seed for me was sown already there. And then I met Andrea, and luckily and fantastically, Andrea had been thinking things that were very compatible. I don't know if they were similar or different, but we just, you know, had this, entered this space where we very quickly found out that we wanted to work together to make this real. And then I think I'll pass the word to you, Andrea, with your entrance, or if you want to provide another context, because there are other contexts, of course, as well, which is about the knowledge economy, university, and the speeding up and the acceleration of research and knowledge practices that is, of course, also a part of the context and our, you know, sense that something is needed for us to slow down analysis. But Andrea, what are you?
Yes, it's a beautiful story of both richness and some things that we're missing. So I don't often think in terms of gaps. I feel that the idea of something the idea of something not existing is an idea that comes from a particular view of the world. This is not to say that everything is out there just waiting for you to look at it, but it is to say that one of the things in which Britt and I converged so nicely was in this feminist inspiration to doing collaborative work that doesn't come from a place of lack, but comes from a place of richness and collaboration and cooperation. without idealizing any of those terms, right? And hence the notion of companionship in the book. Companionship both in the joyous moments, but also in the difficult moments. And so the inspiration for that was largely coming from a number of thinkers, but particularly from the work of Marilyn Strathern, who explicitly had talked about this question of where and how ethnography happens. And we took direct inspiration from her concept of the ethnographic effect. And as we started to unpack that amazing piece of work of hers and realizing the way in which the concept of the ethnographic effect or the ethnographic dazzle had been sort of commodified, in the sense closed off as an object that could travel and could be applied to any circumstance, which is something that, as you might imagine, is not at all the intention of the concept. The concept grows from a particular ethnographic context that demands a certain kind of thinking. And that was the inspiration for this kind of work, for our book. How is it that you don't end up commodifying concepts or insights, but rather producing the concepts and insights that grow out of your ethnographic specificity? So it is in honor of Marilyn Strathern, but refusing the temptation of taking her concept and just circulating it as something that fits everywhere and anywhere. And so with that inspiration, we started thinking, that's all wonderful, but we're both practical and pragmatic people, and also inspired by feminist thought and practice, these are not abstract ideas. These are ideas that have to happen in the world, produced through particular forms of labor, with particular bodies, in particular institutional settings. Hence the comments that Britt was making about the knowledge economy that we're a part of. And so with that in mind, we were looking for resources for guiding ourselves really in this practice of creating, as our contributors say, ethnographic concepts that are attached to their context and yet can also provide insights that can speak to other circumstances. And that is what we understand as analysis, right? That practice of that labor of doing that work. At the same time, we were inspired and we recognized the amazing work that had been published on two ends of the process, if we idealize the process as a linear series of events, which we know it's not, but just for the sake of conversation. There's amazing resources dedicated to fieldwork, both in terms of the ethics and politics, but also in terms of the more conventional or traditional techniques, like how do you do an interview, how do you write field notes, etc. And there's also amazing resources in terms of writing. A lot of those resources really praising beautiful writing and the aesthetics of writing. And yet there was something in the middle that we felt we could pull together to offer to our community of interlocutors. And that was, again, as I said, for the sake of analysis, just creating a linear process that is not such in reality. But that space of analysis, that space of sitting down with all of your fieldworks, all of your fieldwork, your field notes, your images, exactly what you described, Fulya. And what do you do with that? if you don't want to just, rely on a more mechanical approach, which has its place and its uses. But what if you wanted to play a little bit and be more creative with what analysis could become? And that's how we decided that instead of writing a treaty on analysis, the thing to do was to make visible all of the amazing work that so many people were producing, and all of the careful thinking that was happening and hence the contributors to the book, and many other people that some we invited, but they couldn't contribute to the book. Some people we didn't know at that time, and they should be in the book. So this book could be much longer, of course. But that was the idea, to bring together what was already happening in the hands, in the bodies, in the minds, in the souls of so many amazing people, and ask them to work with us in a somewhat unique model. And we can talk about that a little bit later. How is it that, what were the mechanics of publishing this work and getting the contributors to sign up?
Yeah. So throughout the book, it was very easy to see how generous both of you and also all the contributors are. It was really easy to see this collaborative way of looking at analysis and ethnographic research. So in my opinion, the book could be used for methods courses. The protocols in each chapter could be used as assignments, even in several different courses. It could be read before going to the field, after coming back from the field. It could be read when one is just trying to improve their creativity. Honestly, it could be a life companion for many, I think. So what are some of the uses of this book that you imagined while you were preparing this?
Our first thought was that this is a book that should be attractive for both novices and experts in anthropology. So we really wanted to do to make something useful, in the sense that the life companion that you're describing is exactly what we were thinking about. So something that was inviting to craft, but also to unlearn. So that we would have a reader in mind who would maybe in a very senior position, but still wanting to push herself again into a new place. So that is at least one way that we imagined the user. So that's a very broad audience, you could say, but we didn't stop there, because we also thought, well, but people outside the university could also be interested. I mean, one thing is anthropology, expert and novices who are in the field, but how about all the consultancies who use ethnography and do user studies, for example, and also, you know, are really thirsty to discover new things in the material or rediscover other perspectives on old material. So I think we were super naive in terms of audience, in the sense that we just really wanted to make something useful for everybody who would be doing ethnographic world, in order to do what Andrea talked about, the inspiration from Mary Stratton, to have ethnographic effects that were, surprising. Yeah.
I'll add to that also it's one person or one research group could be many, many users or many audiences, or could give each of the chapters many uses, or could just use one chapter. So one of the aims was for the structure of the book, the structure of the chapters themselves, to be flexible, in the sense that you don't, the offerings that the authors make are not tightly regulated steps that need to be followed or else, right? On the contrary, there are suggestions on how to take a certain route, with the full expectation that as you start the travel, you're going to have to make adjustments for this to be generative for your own purposes. And the other thing that I will say is that it also, part of it is, part of the utility is that people might try some things and those things might not work. And this is something that in my pedagogical work, I also really emphasize it's really important to try things, and sometimes for those things to not work, because otherwise you're working from the presumption that anything is possible anywhere, that any of these protocols apply to any project, and of course that's not the case. So we wanted each of the chapters to provide enough so that people could use the protocols, the ideas, the suggestions, but also enough openness and flexibility for people to change what they thought.
Maybe we should introduce a protocol, because I'm not sure we've done that yet, and people who listen may not yet have know about the protocols. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about the format of the book, but Andrea, you can finish your words and then I will continue.
Great, thank you. So this idea of using the chapters and the protocols and finding what doesn't work as well. And the last thing I wanted to say is that it was really so incredible to work with the authors and the way in which they embraced this idea and the way in which all of the chapters are crafted in such a way that they reflect these qualities of openness, but enough structure so that play can unfold. So I'll say maybe briefly, each chapter has a narrative, the text, that takes the reader into the specific ways in which the idea or the analytic technique that an author is proposing has been used by that author. So it's not an abstract description, but a concrete description. And we like to say an ethnographic description of the process of analysis. And then at the end, the chapter has this succinct, condensed, intense set of ideas that we are calling a protocol, which give guidance to the reader on how to take the analytic route that the author has taken in their own projects. But it's enough guide, like I said, enough guidance so that you feel you can do this, but it's not too much guidance in the sense that it doesn't close off what is possible as you encounter your own material by going through this route that the author has proposed.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit more about the format of the book. So it has 19 rather shortish chapters, all written by amazing junior and senior scholars. It then additionally has two afterword pieces from PhD students in different levels of their studies, which I really appreciated. Each chapter is finished with bullet points, analytic protocols suggested by these amazing contributors. So could you tell us how you ended up making the decisions about the format of the book?
Yes, I can start. We discussed the metaphor of the recipe quite a lot in the beginning, Andrea and I, and whether exactly that metaphor of cooking would be quite helpful in relation to this idea that Andrea described so nicely before about we wanting people to be able to follow steps in a process, but also to deviate from them in order to play and revise the protocol or the structure and the points and the steps, the five steps or the process that we were describing for people to be able to open up the material and work through the material in a playful way. So we had this idea, and then we thought, well, really, the notion of a protocol is quite close to the notion of experiment, or it comes from the same world, and we're quite fascinating with experimentating and using that as a, which became later the title of the book, Experimenting with Ethnography. So to try to reclaim that sense that there's both structure, there's also curiosity, there's a lot of material attention, which is something that the protocol and the experiment together really directs your attention to, that you need to take materiality seriously in relation to what you're doing. The experiment can also happen in many different sites. It can be inside a laboratory, it can be in the wild, it can be on the a semi site or in several sites. And so the protocol was a nice anchor in both, I guess, relating to the world of the experiment and experimental sites. So it had a family resemblance there, but it also was an anchor because we know anthropologists well enough to know that maybe it's easier to do something playful than actually to try to follow the steps. And we were also quite committed to communicating, well, maybe you could also try to follow this process and then see what's happening, like going through them several times in order to slow down the analytic process.
I'll also add to that, a counterintuitive dimension to this. We also wanted to remain responsible for the legacies of experimentation and the legacies like racial, economic, colonial legacies of the notion of the experiment. And so we wanted a concept that kept us on our toes, so to speak. So besides that historical legacy, also because of the recognition but that we live in the time of experimentation, right? Experimentation is a thorough neoliberal concept. You need to experiment and innovate and produce the new. It's the ethos of our time. And so we didn't want to be naive about that either. Like, we wanted to recognize this is the moment that we live in, and in some ways we are part of that context in many ways, in all ways, in the ways. And so how to remind ourselves and not mystify experimentation and not mystify innovation and not mystify the new, but keep ourselves aware of the legacies of the protocol as a hierarchical process and as a form of knowledge exclusion. So we also wanted that, in a way, just to remind us that there's no position of purity, right? Like, the work we do is part of these structures and hierarchies, historical and contemporary. And so even if it's exciting and it's seducing to think about the experimental, we also wanted to carry over a little bit of the discomfort that some people that we might associate with the notion of a protocol, particularly in relation to anthropology, where, as Bit was saying, we have a certain ethos of rejecting, in principle at least, those legacies. So it was both exciting and at the same time a reminder of the legacies and the histories that are behind our current moment and the ethos of the experiment at the moment.
Yeah, and this is a quite experimental book in itself, with, as I said, with the 19 chapters and two additional afterword pieces from PhD students, the bullet point approach of protocols. So how was the process of publishing this book, from collecting all these different pieces and working on them to editing and publishing it? And Andrea, I believe you could answer this question.
Yes, it was a really rewarding experience and a really wonderful learning process. And I should say that from the very beginning, we were committed to, and we were lucky enough to be in a position where we could make this commitment to give the time that the project needed, right? We were committed to maybe doing things slowly and maybe taking a long time to publish this. And indeed, we took a long time. The idea in terms of the concrete workshop that happened first, where we began to dream with this book, was in 2016. And so it took a while. We do have 19 contributors, well, more than 19, because there's co-authored pieces. But it was a lot of work to keep all of our, to keep our calendar, that we were very intentional at the very beginning with giving ourselves a very loose calendar so that we could not be in that constant frenzy of always being late with things, as I find myself in the more individual work more often than I should be at the moment. So it took a long time. We also made a commitment that the review process, we had an internal review process where each of the pieces was reviewed by two graduate students who were involved in the project and ourselves as editors. So we had a very thorough and extensive process of review, internal review. And it was really amazing to work with the grad students who are the authors of the two afterwards. They were really incredible. And their contributions, you can see throughout all of the texts. And then another important piece for us was the idea of trying to make the book open access. And we were able to work with the libraries at our universities, with Brits Center at ITU Copenhagen. And by work, I mean collect financial resources. Duke was open to making the book open access. And that was really wonderful because we really hope that this book can travel. And so just a quick note, if you want the physical book, you can, of course, purchase it from Duke's website and other booksellers. But if you want the PDF, you can download it from a number of locations, including my own website. So if you're interested, definitely download it and spread it around the world.
That's amazing. It's also go ahead.
I should say, sorry, I forgot to say one more piece, which was the reviewers from Duke University Press, who were also incredible. And in fact, we should say that we had a couple of other friends read the introduction and give us really fantastic feedback. But in addition to that, the reviewers pushed us in really important ways, encouraged us. We all need encouragement. And they made us, they confirmed the sense that we had that the book was going to find homes and hands and minds in its travels. And actually, the title of the book changed and it became what it is because of a suggestion of one of the reviewers. So big thank you to whoever that person is. We are actually going to use the ethnographic effect.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and we also had our very first working title was "This is How We Did It," because our idea was inviting people whose work we admired and inviting them to write a fairly personal piece under a fairly harsh structure. So that was our invitation to them to share some of their processes, so opening up their ways of working, but you know, under this framework that we've already described with the protocol. So I think that's also really part of the book's core, that all the authors accepted to share some of themselves in a way that is not quite similar to how you do a standard scientific publication. There's a little more of them in there, I would say. You know, no, not of them. This is wrong. So it's not autoethnography or anything in that sense, but it's actually inviting the reader into their work processes and generalizing from there, you could say, with the protocol.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I was just going to ask you about the title of the book. Mm-hmm. So it's great that you mentioned you changed the title a couple of times. So experimenting with ethnography. Experiment, as Britt said, is often used for studies on physical sciences, but you kind of reclaim this term in the book. And in the second afterword written by the PhD students, they also mention, the first one. So they also mention how experimenting is very similar to questioning. So I wonder what does experimenting mean for you in this context? And what does experimenting with ethnography mean? And I also wonder if it is related to your experiences in experimental spaces like the Ethnography Studio and Ethos Lab. So I'm really curious about the title, like how, what is experimenting here? And Britt, you can go ahead if you wish.
Yes. I mean, there's a common sense aspect of experimentation that is a liberating in a way, you know, that it, as I said before, if you focus on it from a natural science perspective, it's very much about constraint and the generosity that constraints can have. You know, if you know your setup, if you know your material, if you know how you're doing your recording, you have your overall question, and you can you measure and you test and you revise and you follow each step. But there's also in the common parlor, when we use experimentation, it's also very much about being open-ended. And as Andrea so eloquently put it, it's also part of our, you know, the innovation economy, that experimentation is good. But we wanted to, you know, not to put too much value on either on the constraining part or the liberating part, but sort of keep them in the picture together and, you know, look at them and feel them and say, you know, this is it using experimentation in the ethnographic practice in this sort of open-ended way is helpful sometimes, and in the constraining way is helpful sometimes. And we need to expand our repertoires there, but know what we're doing. So it's very much about knowing what kind of experimentation we are engaging in, to be, you know, aware and actively, you know, sort of questioning also the very setup of our analytical assumptions and our methods for bringing forth a particular point and or using this or the other concept. So I think for me that doubleness is a very productive one that is in the notion of the experimental.
Yeah, Andrea, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, just briefly. That was really great. An important part of the puzzle here was that experimentation doesn't have a predetermined form, right? We wanted to just convey this sense that for us, a form is not automatically experimental, right? So at this moment in history, when there's so much exciting work going with the multimodal, for instance, or at some other moment in history where the experimental was all textual, for us it was really important to put on the table resources, tools, techniques that give you the joys and the pleasures and also the headaches of being experimental without necessarily having to adopt a predetermined form. Because we can find a lot of ethnographic work that is experimental in the sense of being multimodal or and in terms of analytics, it's not that experimental, right? And so you don't have to adopt the latest technology, or you don't have to write in a particular kind of way to be experimental. The experimental orientation is something that undergirds, it's that bubbling that happens before the pasta is cooked, right? And then the pasta could be amazing in so many different ways. But it's not how it looks at the end that determines that something is experimental only.
Yeah. So when I look at the book, I saw some common themes across all these 19 chapters and even in the afterwards. So we have immersion, we have collaboration, we have the importance of non-unified theory, non-universal thinking, but still analytical and systematic and in-depth thinking done through rigorous and deep analysis, and the fact that all of these scholars are focusing on the how of the analysis and not on the what of the analysis. So can you tell us a bit about some common themes on analysis under which all of these contributors of the book worked? And Britt, you can go ahead.
Yes, I mean, we had these 19 chapters and we'd all given each author some kind of assignment or some kind of, you know, expectation that they could, of course, negotiate. But based on what we knew they were working on, we had some idea of what we would like them to write about. But then we had some wildly different chapters that we would somehow have to organize. And I think Andrea has put it very nicely when she says that it's what you see, you know, we have four parts in the book, but they're like temporary orderings that worked at the moment where we had to organize them, because I think they can be organized in other ways as well. But what we ended doing was to focus one on the bodily practices and relocations. So that's part one. So that's a lot. Of course, like a big theme in anthropology is the ethnographer's body, but also what kind of, other bodies that this ethnographer body relates to and how it's sometimes displayed in unexpected ways. And the chapters in this section tries to work on questions around the individual ethnographer also in a collective, let's say, field work setting, and how do you work with serendipity, for example, or your hunches in that way, and so that was a theme coming out there. Then we have a part two, which is on physical objects, where you have chapters on anthropologists experimenting with objects exchange, for example, or with the drawing as a way of analyzing. Both making diagrams and drawings and using material objects in order to elucidate particular parts of, again, either individually framed or collectively framed field sites. We have postcards that are sent and objects that are being exchanged. Then we have the part three, which we call infrastructural play. And that is on, for example, the multimodal and also using digital technology in ethnographic fieldwork and analysis and writing. But interestingly, it also has a lot of the more traditional infrastructures that anthropologists have worked through, for example, archives and recording techniques. So there's some questions there around, so what are the infrastructures that we use and the technologies both for data collection and for analysis and for dissemination or engagement of the material and the analysis. And then the last part is called incommensurabilities, which is, of course, a huge topic in anthropology, worlds that connect or don't connect, or ontologies that are radically different, like this fundamental questions about culture is worked through these chapters with also concepts like analogy and decolonization. So the last part is very much about knowledge and our conditions for creating knowledge and basically, you know, our capacities to work with and through and in worlds that we don't understand or try to understand, ending with, again, a theme that is actually going again through the whole book, about what is it that we know, how can we not know, and what is overflowing our techniques and concepts of knowing. So I think that would be my very rough presentation of something that is a temporary ordering.
That's amazing. Andrea, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll say that I really recommend that people read the two afterwords that were written by Melanie Ford-Lemus and Katie Ulrich and Clement Drano and Marcus Rudolphi, who at the moment were PhD students. And they are really beautiful pieces that actually, I should say that at some point we were thinking about bringing those to the very beginning, but we would have ended with like three introductions and no way to close the book. They are really powerful pieces in helping us picture the location of all of these chapters in the in both the bookshelf as a literal place, but also in the process of putting together a research project. And those pieces speak not only to PhD students, speak to all of us who are starting new projects. And I'll just say that in the introduction, Britt and I also lay some of the elements that we've shared with you in this conversation, sort of inviting the reader to come into the book, sharing this orientation towards systematic play, if you will, and also this invitation to remain open, to wonder about the things that we have in front of us, while at the same time acknowledging the structures and hierarchies that we are a part of, and not forgetting those.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for taking us through this book and your thinking. We have taken up a lot of your time, so I will now move to my last question. So what are you working on now, and what would be your next project? And we can start with Britt.
Thank you. Yes, I'm working on welfare services in the digitalized state. And that is something that really needs a lot of experimental techniques, because it's a field that is very much just next to me, just right here where I'm also based. I'm also a citizen and also a recipient of welfare services. So I'm trying to find out what it is about the Nordic welfare model that other people look at, and how that connect with digitalization of public sector services. And that is happening as part of a research center for digital welfare that I'm also heading, and where researchers look at different aspects of this, the welfare that transpires in the encounter between the citizen and the welfare state. So that's my interest now at the moment.
And I'm actually... It's interesting because I'm not beginning this project. I've been thinking about this for a while, but only now am I being able to conduct extended fieldwork. So it feels like I'm starting again in a very interesting way. So this is a project that I call Expanding the Social World Downwards, and it's looking at the ways in which our spatial imaginaries, notions of property and scientific knowledge about aquifers reshape how we relate to the world underground. And by we, I mean people in Costa Rica, where I'm from and where I'm conducting this research. So in this project, I will be learning new techniques. I will be learning GIS, and I will be working on creative remappings of the underground. I'm particularly interested in how aquifers have been forgotten from history. So if you think about the underground, you usually think about mines or caves. But if you think about underground space from the perspective of aquifers and water flowing, you have to completely reorganize your spatial imaginaries. And this is something that's happening as we speak here in Costa Rica. So I'm trying to understand the role of science and the ways in which private property changes or not as a result of this work. And I will be here for a few months and hopefully writing a book about this in the near future.
Amazing, amazing projects. We'll certainly be looking forward to your next projects. Thank you so, so much, Andrea and Britt, for your time, for joining us, for sharing your insights with us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Fulvia, thank you so much. It was really amazing to talk to you. Great to hear you, Britt. I haven't seen you for a while, given what the world is experiencing. And it's been lovely to talk with both of you and to the listeners. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm your host, Fulvia Pnar. This discussion of experimenting with ethnography, a companion to analysis published by the Duke University Press in 2021, is brought to you by the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.